From simple to gourmet, nothing's fresher or tastier in recipes than homegrown, vine-ripened veggies and savory herbs. Do you grow your own? With Bonnie Plants, a kitchen garden at your back door or in containers can produce an amazing harvest for cooking and for sharing. Find how-tos, plans, and more at BonniePlants.com. Your recipes might not change, but your results sure will. Fresh, healthy Bonnie veggies and herbs. Get growing.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we are at the International Culinary Center today, and my guest is one of my favorite graduates of this school, Ed McFarlane. For those of you who might not know Ed, you probably know him from Ed's Lobster Bar. Yes, he is the epitomous Ed of Ed's Lobster Bar. But maybe some of the others have seen him on the TV Food Network or the Martha Stewart Show, CBS, NBC, PIX, Daily Candy, Food and Wine, the New York Times. I can go on and on and on. Everybody writes about Ed because he's been known to have one of the best lobster rolls in New York City. Even New York Magazine said he had the best lemonade. So, and he's a winner of Food Network's Food Feuds for the lobster roll. And his restaurant, you know, lobster roll restaurants don't get Michelin stars, but Michelin couldn't overlook them and gave him a bib gourmand. You know, those are those little bibs. If you get the Michelin guide, they give a bib to those restaurants that they like the best. You know, because a three-star restaurant's really fancy, and a one-star restaurant has to kind of be fancy. But a bib restaurant says, this is what it's supposed to be, and it's one of our favorites. So welcome, Ed. It's a great honor and privilege to have you here today.
Thank you. It's nice to see you, Dorothy.
Oh, boy. Okay, so you're a New York boy, right?
I am. I'm originally from Staten Island.
Staten Island. Yeah. Okay, so I want to hear your story. Tell me about growing up in Staten Island and, you know, what were some of your first food memories?
You know, okay, so we're going to actually jump back a little bit to Brooklyn because I was born in Brooklyn and I was raised for a short period of time. And my first food memories are Italian-American food and outdoor grilling of chicken and steaks and burgers.
So
this is in Brooklyn. And so my mom would be making meatballs with my grandmother, chicken parmesan, baked ziti, stuff along those lines. And outside, my dad would be grilling chicken that marinated for hours in vinegar with onions and burgers. We had the butcher deliver meat to the house every week.
What neighborhood?
We were right on the border of Borough Park and Bensonhurst. We grew up next door to the 66 precinct, and we actually had a yard, cherry trees, peach trees, fruit and vegetable garden. It was unbelievable.
Wow. And so how old were you when they wrenched you out of Brooklyn and crossed the Verrazano Bridge?
10 years old.
You were 10. What did you feel like going to Staten Island at 10?
You know, it was really, really interesting because going from Brooklyn to Staten Island at that time, I would say it's like 1984 or so, 83, somewhere around there. It was like being in the country to me. There was nothing around. You know, we had stores and the Italian deli and we had 18th Avenue and Staten Island. You couldn't walk for miles and find a store when we moved there.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty rural at the time. Now it's vastly overpopulated. You can't drive a mile without it taking an hour.
Was it hard to acculturate?
No, it was pretty easy. I mean, I was young, so you make friends really easily with neighborhood
kids. So did your parents go back to Brooklyn to buy stuff?
Yes, they did go back to Brooklyn to buy stuff. So absolutely. For a long time until we got acclimated to where stuff was, they definitely went back to the butcher and to the markets in Brooklyn to purchase food.
So you're growing up in Staten Island. When you were 14, what did you think you'd be when you grew up?
You know, I had no idea what I'd be at 14. And, you know, every kid, their mom asks them, what are you going to be when you grow up? What do you want to do? And, you know, I always probably had some smart-ass comment and was, I was going to be this or I was going to be that. I had no idea. What did I do? Well, I went to school, and at 16 years old, I started working in the Italian restaurant across the street from my high school. And I started as a busboy, and I washed dishes. And that would be my first true restaurant experiences.
And you did it for money, not because you wanted to eat the food at the restaurant?
No, I did it because I needed to have a job and work and for money.
So what was it like, that first job?
You know, it was pretty interesting, and it could get a little stereotypical. So it was definitely a typical red sauce place, and the cooks were the nastiest guys you'd ever meet, especially to a busboy.
Tell me a story.
Oh, they yell at you like crazy. So there was this one guy, and I want to say his name was Jerry, but it may not have been. And so he'd always ride us. We had to make the garlic bread. So we had to go back in the kitchen, and, you know, small 16-year-old kid, and I'd have to take the garlic and rub it on the bread, and he'd be yelling at me the whole time while I was doing it, and you'd have to stick it in the broiler, and then he'd make fun of you because you couldn't reach in and pull it out because it was hot and you didn't want to burn your hands. So I probably worked there for, I want to say, about a year and a half. And towards the end, he was really riding me one time. So when I took the bread out of the oven, I put it on a sizzle platter. And by that time, I had learned a little bit. So you use the tongs, you grab the rag, and so it was kind of an on-purpose accident. And the tray was kind of clean, so I stuck the tray right back on top of the cool trays. And 5 minutes later, I won't repeat exactly what he said, but there was a bunch of curses, and I'm going to kill him.
So, you know, what did you learn from that job that you carry with you today?
You know what? There were a lot of hard workers there. They all worked hard. They all worked long hours. And they were dedicated to what they were doing. And that's what I really took out of being at that restaurant.
So after that, what happened? After high school, what happened?
So I went to work in a pizzeria kitchen, and I started making heroes and dough, sauce. And it wasn't the best food, but once again, the one thing that was prevalent there was it was a family business. It was an uncle and his nephew that had the pizzeria. And they worked all the time, and they worked hard, and that was a very good learning experience there as well. But I made chicken parmesan heroes and sausage and peppers and pasta plates and stuff like that.
So that doesn't sound like the journey to being a chef and making it in Manhattan and having this really, you know, making it to the Martha Stewart show. I mean, so what? When did the chef or the, you know, getting across to Manhattan happen in your brain? When did the Ed McFarlane percolate?
So, you know, back at that time, I probably had two jobs. I had a summer job and then the pizzeria job. And I had started going to college, and I went to college for a couple of years, and I realized that I did not want to sit in a classroom. I couldn't do it. I didn't go to class. I was wasting my money and my time. I was at Fordham. And I was playing hockey at the time up there, so that's basically why I went to college. It was a club team, but I had fun, so I could keep playing hockey and skating.
You paid a lot to play hockey.
I did pay a lot to play hockey. And I probably didn't get everything I needed to out of that portion of my education just because I spent too much time going to the bar instead of going to class.
I think there's a lot of people out there relating to you right now.
But most of them probably finished their education at some point. So I worked with as a checker with the longshoremen on the docks while I worked at the pizzeria. I worked at the Board of Elections. I mean, I had various other odd jobs that I'd keep myself occupied during the day before I went to work at night and keep myself out of trouble. So, and really, the true part of the story is I basically went to bed one night and woke up the next morning and said, I'm going to go to culinary school. Boom, it was just like that, snap your finger. I went to bed and woke up and said that to myself.
But you hadn't been working at fine dining restaurants.
Not even close. I don't even think I ate at a fine dining restaurant at that point in time.
Well, where do you think that came from?
I don't know. You know, food was very prevalent in my house, and I can remember as a kid my mom and dad watching food shows on PBS, And a favorite of mine was, and I hope I get the name right, it was, I think it was World-class chefs or something like that, or world-class cuisine, and it was always dubbed over, and they had all these European chefs on cooking these dishes, and some woman did the dubbed over voice. And I can remember watching shows like that on PBS and really enjoying them. So maybe the home cooking, the watching it on PBS, and somewhere it got in my head that, hey, you know what? I'm a pretty good cook. I think that I can do this for a living.
Wow. So you came...
Well, I tell you what, I picked up an issue of Gourmet magazine that next day, and I started flipping through the pages, and I saw this ad for the French Culinary Institute, and I started doing some research about it, and I said to myself, that's where I want to go to school.
So how, when you came into school, you thought you knew a bit about food, right?
You know what? I thought I knew a good amount about food. But the one thing I think that helped me was I knew nothing about technique.
I see. So how different was your concept? Because you have been working in the restaurant industry for a long time already.
Yeah, probably close to 5 or 6 years at the time.
So how different was what was being taught in school different from what you were doing in the restaurant before?
It was extremely, extremely different. I mean, there was in the Italian pizzeria, we'll say, it was kind of just, if you ran out of something, you ordered it. There was no real uniform way we did things. They had recipes, but there was no real uniform set way to follow it. If you fry the cutlet, throw the sauce in the pan, or throw the sauce in the pan, throw the cutlet in. There was no uniformity done to what they did other than the pizza dough and making pizza. Everything else was kind of just whatever order you did it in, you did it in.
So it taught you process?
Well,
it taught you technique? It taught you...
Coming to school? You mean the pizzeria?
No.
Coming to school.
Because I think for some young... There are a lot of young chefs out there who listen to this. And, you know, they may be working in Brooklyn today at a red sauce restaurant and saying, how do I get to be Ed McFarlane in New York? And what are those steps that I have to do to get there? And there are certain ways to, lots of different ways to run restaurants. And lots, as you said, to learn technique. There are a lot of people out there who are running restaurants who never learn proper techniques. So, you know, what did it do, what did you learn in school that you carry with you today that maybe if you didn't go to school you wouldn't have?
So what I wouldn't have was a basic understanding and knowledge of the culinary process for recipes and for the knife techniques, the proper cutting of the vegetables and fruits and the different techniques related to that. I would have never had that. Those were things I had no knowledge of, cutting julienne or macedoine. I think it's very important because it's stuff that you're going to use throughout your whole career. Every restaurant you work in, whether it's somebody else's or your own, you're going to cut vegetables, you're going to cut meats, you're going to do all sorts of things. And especially the sauce making process, you're going to use basic stocks and sauces as roots for everything. And I learned that at school here.
So did you, when you went to school, did you say, I want to own my own place when you were here? Or before you even came to school, was that, you know, having your own place part of your life plan?
Yeah, you know, having my own place was definitely part of my plan when I started to come to, when I went to culinary school. I didn't know what I wanted to do at the time. I just knew that at some point I wanted to have my own place.
So the school is only 6 months. So did you have a sense when you came in where you wanted to work when you got out?
You know, I knew so little about the New York City culinary scene and all the great chefs that were out here and the all great chefs that were affiliated with the school. And over the course of time, I learned. But it wasn't until I started working in the a la carte kitchen here that I really started to hone in what type of restaurant that I wanted to work in.
So where did you go?
I ended up going to Picholine.
Picholine,
yeah,
with
Terrence Brennan, yeah.
Yeah,
and that was an unbelievable experience. I tell you, I think that he has one of the best palates in the food industry.
Really?
I really do.
So what did, What was it like working in that type of restaurant?
You know, it was a very stressful environment. I started there when he was going from 2 stars to 3 stars, and I was probably there only a couple months before they started the review process. So it was a pretty stressful time, and everything had to be impeccably perfect. And
so wait, your palate at this time, you're saying you never really even ate at a fine dining restaurant before you came to school. What was your palate like, and had it changed? Had you been tasting things in school, or was there anything to prepare you for that?
You know, I tasted stuff in school, but nothing along the lines that I tasted when I started working there. I mean, I tasted things that now I eat, like sea urchin, that I wouldn't even, that I spit out of my mouth when I tasted it there, when I first tasted it. So, but it was great because I got to start working with all this really interesting and different product. But it was a tough environment. It was a small kitchen, and it was kind of old school. It was an old school kitchen.
What do you mean by that?
That there was a lot of yelling, and it was you know, eat or be eaten in there. So you really had to commit yourself that was where you wanted to be, and put your nose down and grind away every day.
So a year and a half later?
2 years later.
I spent
two full years there, yeah.
Is that an important part of a chef's journey, to spend a substantial amount of time under one master to really get a sense of...
I think the more time you can spend with each individual chef that is a great chef in whatever city you're in, somebody 8 months, 1 year, I really don't think you get the full understanding of what goes on and what gets put into putting the product on the table and and giving the customers the complete experience. In a year, you don't find that out.
So you really do have to...
Yeah, I think 2, 3, 4, 5 years, if you can do it, is absolutely worth it, because things change. Most of the chefs that are hot chefs are always on the cutting edge of food, and still always going to work with the great products available.
So we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to come right back.
From simple to gourmet, nothing's fresher or tastier in recipes than homegrown, vine-ripened veggies and savory herbs. Do you grow your own? With Bonnie Plants, a kitchen garden at your back door or in containers can produce an amazing harvest for cooking and for sharing. Find how-tos, plans, and more at BonniePlants.com. Your recipes might not change, but your results sure will. Fresh, healthy Bonnie veggies and herbs. Get growing.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Ed McFarlane from Ed's Lobster Bar in New York City, and we're just talking about his journey to opening Ed's. So after Picheline, where did you go?
After Picheline, in a roundabout way, I ended up at Le Cirque 2000.
Ah, and who was the chef then?
Sotha Kuhn was the chef.
Oh, Sotha
Kuhn. Yes.
He was a fabulous chef.
Yes, fantastic. He was a very, very...
What was that like? That was one of the hottest restaurants in the city.
It was hot. That was a really tough kitchen. And I tell you what, I didn't spend a lot of time there. So against my thinking, I actually moved on from there pretty quickly after about 9 months. It was an interesting environment. I think that you had a lot of people come in. It was the opening of a restaurant. And as with most openings, people come and go. And the food was fantastic there, but it was on such a massive, massive scale. I felt it was kind of easy to get lost in the shuffle.
At Picheline, how many covers a night were you doing?
300.
And how many were you doing at Le Cirque 2000?
When I was on the lunch crew, we would do 700, 800 lunches. I think they had to be doing about 1,500 covers a day there.
Wow.
I mean, that's massive.
Massive.
Yeah.
Massive, massive. So after Le Cirque?
I bounced around a little bit. I worked at Le Taxi on 60th Street for a while. That was a French bistro. I worked at a bistro uptown on 94th Street. And then I at some point, I got direction back in my career, and I went to work at Pearl Oyster Bar in the West Village.
And then after Pearl?
6 years.
6 years?
6 years. I opened Ed's Lobster Bar.
What did it take? What kind of confidence do you have to have to say, okay, I'm opening my own place in Manhattan? This is like, you know, with the New York Times and everybody else breathing down your neck.
One of the things for me that became important throughout the years in my career, even going back to when I first was working at Picheline, was that if I was going to open up a restaurant, it was going to be in Manhattan. The fail rate is extremely high, but to be successful in Manhattan was, to me, the epitome of the culinary industry. You could be successful in small towns, but there were small town chefs come to New York and they're just not successful. So to me, it was very important for me to be in New York City and establish a restaurant in New York City. For whatever reason, that was just the way I felt. You have to be above and beyond. You're going to work harder than you did for anybody else. So it throw out the window how hard you think you work for somebody. When you're opening up your own place, it's 10, 20, 30 times more work. And it's 100 times harder. And every detail.
Do you have a partner?
I have one business partner, but he is not a hands-on partner. He was a money backer.
So it was all on your shoulders?
All on my shoulders, and it's still all on my shoulders.
So did you have to work with the architects, the designer, doing your own menu? That's great. That was probably the easy part. That was the vacation, right?
That is the easy part, is making the menu, because you kind of have an idea of what you want to serve before you open up, and you've been working on recipes for, I don't know, 15 to 20 years, 10 years, whatever it is. You have recipes. You have cooking techniques you already learned. But what do I know about architecture? I don't know anything. What do I know about building permits and city permits and plumbing? Zero. And I worked with everybody.
Did you have an architect, or did you just use a contractor?
I used a contractor.
So that was challenging?
It was challenging, but they were fantastic. Just from the fact if I said, hey, we want to have white marble bar. Bang, they built a white marble bar. And it was, well, you need enough. And they knew a lot of the codes and everything else. So they spaced everything. And, I mean, I spoke with architects, and I did have an architect come in and kind of do a rough drawing for me. But we never actually did any real plans for the space. And it was almost kind of shoot from the hip. So we knew we wanted a white marble bar, and I had bought somebody out of their space. And there were tables there, and just one day we said, hey, we're going to make white marble tables. And bang, we had white marble tables.
So how did you conceive the first menu? What was your concept?
So the concept was all lobster. And other than the lobster roll, my intention was to distance myself as much as I could from my past experiences, but I still wanted them to be connected, obviously, because that's my background in cooking. So I started really playing with the lobster as soon as the kitchen was ready, cooking lobster and doing anything I really could with lobster. And I knew I wasn't going to serve any meat, but I knew I needed to have other options. So I knew I wanted to put a raw bar in there, but I knew it couldn't be vast. It couldn't be a Balthazar-style raw bar. There wasn't going to be.
What does that mean?
To me, that's the Grand Plateau with king crab and 10 different oysters. And yeah, and that's not me. That's not my style. But, you know, to incorporate raw bar, but just an East Coast version of East Coast only oysters and stuff like that was what I worked out that would be best. And I wanted it to be as much a reflection of New England food, but New York as well.
So why lobster? I mean, why a lobster bar? Was it from the business element that you thought New York could use a lobster bar? Or are you in love with lobsters?
You know, it probably started about 4 years before I opened the restaurant. And I started thinking about, you know, I knew I wanted to just do a seafood restaurant. I started thinking, what do I like to eat? What is not around all over the place? And what's going to be something fun to work with? And it was kind of like, well, you know, lobster bar. You know, people have oyster bars, clam bars. Why not a lobster bar? Why not a restaurant that really just celebrates lobster as the main attraction?
So do you find, when you opened, how easy, were you immediately filled with all the lobster lovers of New York, or how did people react to it?
You know, it was pretty excellent, actually, and it was much different than what I expected. I expected to open up on, you know, a cold Friday, and I wouldn't have any press, and I just have this small little neighborhood restaurant that had 50 chairs in it, and, you know, slowly we'd build a reputation, and customers would come, and it would get popular over the course of, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 years, but, you know, we'd progress along each year. And we got a mention in the New York Times before we opened. We had a write.
How did you get that?
I called Florence Fabricant, and she did it. Yeah,
okay.
And I had never met her.
Take note out there.
I had never met her before, but Pashinac, who was the chef de cuisine at the time at Picholine, after this is years after.
David Pashinac. He was who's Eska.
Yeah, he's a great fish guy. So
great
yeah.
fish guy. He was at Picholine.
Yeah,
too.
He was the chef de cuisine.
Oh my gosh.
And at some point in time, he said to me, and I don't know if I saw him right before I opened the place or it was a couple years before, he said, you're going to meet a lot of people in the industry. He goes, when you open your own place, you got to call them. You got to call them and ask for stuff. You just got to do it. And that's what I did. I just called and I said, hey, I'm opening up this restaurant. I worked here, and Florence came down to the restaurant and spoke with me and looked around, and she said, no problem. We're going to give you a little mention that you're opening up.
Nice.
And the night we opened, we got a write-up from Daily Candy, which was unbelievably great piece of press. But the other interesting part was I didn't realize how much pre-opening buzz I actually had. I filmed the Martha Stewart Show the day I opened the restaurant.
Oh, my. Wow.
So, and we...
You were on the show.
I was on the show the day that the restaurant opened. Yeah.
That's pretty big press.
Yeah.
So how many people, how many lobsters did you serve your first night?
You know, I think we went through in the first two nights probably like 500 pounds of lobster. It was just dinner. And I had to close on Sunday because we were so overwhelmed by the amount of demand we had. I couldn't open up on Sunday. I had to close, get prepped on Monday, and reopen on Tuesday for a full week of business. It was hailing outside. There was about 70 people online to come into the restaurant. And I looked out the door and I went, we're in trouble.
Nice trouble.
Yes, nice
Better
trouble.
Better than
yeah.
having the empty restaurant.
Yeah.
So what do you wish you knew? Like, how else would you have prepared yourself for opening your own place if you could do it again?
I wish I just had more of a business background. I think that's the part where I suffered the most, and probably most chefs do. I spent my whole career cooking and fine-tuning my skills and learning as much as I could about food product and anything that had to do with food, that I probably didn't learn enough about the business side and the accounting side and the expense side of things, which, you know, you can learn. You can learn on the job. I think it's better if you know ahead of time. But I did surround myself with good people. I had good people helping me out with office work and as far as also expediting permits and stuff for me. So I knew a little bit about to have people help me. But I think that more understanding of the business side of things before you open up as a chef, before you venture out in, would have helped me a lot more.
So how many years have you been open right now?
7 years.
7 years. So what are your challenges now, other than, you know, for that first night? How do you keep the restaurant, in the, you know, with the 70 people outside the door?
You know, you have to constantly stay in the public's know. New restaurants open up all the time. They do similar things, and they do great food as well. But you still have to every day challenge yourself. You have to make yourself do a better job every day. You have to constantly improve on whatever it is you're doing, even if it's the same food item. I constantly strive to just keep improving what we do at the restaurant every single day.
How has the menu changed?
The menu hasn't changed drastically over the course of 7 years, but what's changed is every year I seem to develop a new lobster dish that makes its way onto the menu, or something along the lines with lobster.
So, the lobster bar is near here. Every time I go, I don't really see you, but you know, I love it because I know what I want when I go in there.
Yeah.
That's also the bane of cooks. They all want to change the menu to do something new. How do you keep your cooks keeping to do the same recipe? Because that's a challenge too. Because the young cooks in the kitchen, they like, give me a new recipe. I want, you know, let's change this up, you know.
Do you know what they want to learn? And they want to learn all different things. And I've managed to keep my staff for a long time. So my sous chef, who's been with me since day one, she now handles all the cooking of the lobster. She's been with me for 7 years.
How do you keep someone like that?
You beat them into submission. No, you treat them fairly. And I think at the end of the day, opening a restaurant and being involved in a restaurant is stressful. People who are in the industry know it, but at some point it's not. It's about treating people fairly as well. And I think that's what I do.
Probably having come up through the school of hard knocks that you came up.
Yes.
Okay, well, we're going to take another little break here. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about, you know, what's going on with our oceans and sourcing your product.
Yes.
Listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Ed McFarlane from Ed's Lobster Bar in Manhattan. And you know, you're as a lobster bar, and having a lobster as your main plate, a lot of people just want it steamed. They just want the lobster. So it really depends on sourcing the right product. What's going on with our oceans? How does that affect a restaurateur like yourself? How does it affect, you know, prices, flavor? Tell, you know, we're hearing about environment, climate change, all of this. How do you perceive it from your point of view?
You know, I think that fishing methods are very important to make sure that we're using sustainable fishing methods. Fishing for lobster does not harm the environment, to my knowledge.
No.
I've become over the years friendly with some of the scientists up at University of Maine in Roanoke. They run the Lobster Institute. In contact with them from time to time to discuss what's going on. But as far as from a lobster perspective, they're fairly abundant. They really, really up in Maine, there's no natural predator left since the cod was overfished. Down here, which affects the pricing for us, is there's really no...
Let me go. The natural predator, which is the codfish...
Up in Maine it was yes.
Right. And yeah. So the codfish would eat a whole lobster?
They eat the small lobsters.
Oh, they eat the small ones.
The small lobsters,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah, and anything that eats, and lobsters eat themselves, and any other bottom feeder predator that can suck a small lobster in through its mouth and break it up in its gills, like a striped bass or seals eat lobsters, and so on and so forth.
But the biggest predator was
codfish. Yeah. That's to my knowledge.
And now the codfish is gone, so the lobsters have proliferated.
Yes. But also, you know, up in Maine and Canada, they do a great job of sustaining their industry through various methods. V-notching the lobsters, where they cut a V in the females bearing eggs and throw them back in. Not taking any lobsters visibly bearing egg sacs on the outside, or they bring them to hatcheries. They hatch the lobsters in the hatcheries, and then they disperse them along the ocean floor with reverse vacuums, usually into rocky areas, so the small lobsters can hide and not be eaten by larger fish and other lobsters.
So tell me about this institute up in Maine. It just specializes on studying lobster.
They specialize in studying lobster and sustainability of lobster. And what they do is they're kind of trying to bring the science together with the fishermen and the processors, so that there's an understanding of how they can keep this industry going forever, so that they don't keep dropping a million traps in the water and pulling a million lobsters up every day, or I don't know the catch numbers, but every year it's a record catch, and you know they think it's going to go on forever, but nothing like that can go on forever. Eventually, something's going to happen with the cycle, and they're not going to catch as many lobsters as they were catching. So that's basically what they do. They run a conference every year, which I spoke at a bunch of years back, and it just basically talks about the sustainability of lobster, and that's what they're working towards.
So is there a difference between New York lobster? Because I know you can catch lobster off of New York.
You know, it's interesting.
And Maine lobster?
The Maine lobster is at much colder water. It's much sweeter, in my opinion. And the faster you get it out of the water to your table, the more the flavor stays with the lobster. I think when they come out of the water up north and they drop them in tanks down here before you get them, it kind of changes the flavor a little bit.
But the tanks have chemicals in them, right?
It's usually salt water filtered tanks and anything they need to keep the environment clean that they're putting them in.
Yes. Well, another kind of filter. So, your education really never stops, does it?
It's continuous. You're continually learning and that's part of the industry. I mean, basically, when I left culinary school here, I was told by one of the chefs that was my instructor, what we gave you was the ability to go out and learn how to become a chef. We taught you the techniques. We taught you the process. Now it's up to you to go and learn and keep continually educate yourself and become better and better.
So how do you do that?
I think it's staying up on cooking trends. It's going and eating at other restaurants, seeing what other people are doing with their food, and traveling. I think traveling to different parts of the country, different countries, eating seafood in different places, seeing how it's harvested, talking with the scientists, talking with the fishermen, talking with other chefs. It's all part of the process of educating yourself and learning more.
So give me an example of someplace you've traveled recently that inspired you.
So recently, let's say 2 years ago, I was in Menfi in Sicily, and I went down to Sciacca, which is right on the southern coast there. And as the fishing boats were coming in, I saw how they were bringing in the fish and the different way in which that they got the fish and seafood to their restaurants than what happens here. It's so different.
That's
because
how so?
Well, there you just. They went, you know, the restaurateurs or the chefs, they just went down to the dock with a cart. And they basically bought directly as the fish came off the boat, the shrimp and whatever other fish they came in. And I went to eat at a local restaurant in Memphis. And they did some great crudos there and some really interesting stuff. And I was at the Planeta Winery, and I worked with the chef there. And we made arancini rice balls. We used local Mediterranean lobsters to make them, which is not the same product
no,
we have
not,
here.
No.
It's very, but we made some with shrimp and all different things. So that's was a great culinary experience for me.
Have you ever had Swedish blue lobster?
I have not had Swedish blue lobster.
Well, you know I'm a big lobster person
because
of my Cape Breton roots. And, you know, the Swedes are always fighting with me that their blue lobster is better. And I've not tasted it either. But I figure your palate I would trust.
Have you
tried the Scottish blue lobster that sells like for $25 a pound?
I have not tried that either, no.
You're certainly not selling it.
No, I'm not selling it at Ed's Lobster
Bar.
I mean, I'm using Canadian and Maine products specifically when it comes to the lobster.
The greatest lobster in the world.
Absolutely.
The greatest lobster. So tell me about the bar end of Ed's Lobster Bar. You know, I think there's, as I said before, a lot of people out there who would love to run a restaurant like yours. I think you have, in my opinion, one of the most perfect restaurants.
Thank
for
you.
A chef. Really. No, it's focused. First of all, I love the look of it. You know, it's very inviting. It's always clean. 7 years, you walk past there, you don't think it's a seven-year-old. It doesn't show the signs of wear and tear. It's classic. Ed's Lobster Bar. You know, 100 years from now, and 100 years ago, you could have an Ed's Lobster Bar, and you're still going to want to go in there if you feel like that or you're a lobster lover. And then the bar is so perfect, and the small room in the back. And to be a chef-owned restaurant, it has personality. You know, a restaurant has to have a personality and a point of view. It has the point of view. It has your personality in it. I think people listening to you see you're a real direct guy. You know what you're talking about. You're going to, you love what you do, and it comes across on the plate. How much of the bar is your business, and how much is it the food?
You know,
and it's not a big bar scene. It's one of those great bars you can sit at and eat. But the bar is really well done.
You know, I don't have a big bar scene at all, actually. And 75% of my sales are food sales. And
really?
Yeah, 75%
oh
my God. Of my sales are food sales. And one of the things we did, because our dining room is so limited in size, was during peak times, you can't sit down and have a drink at the restaurant. You actually have to be eating. So we kind of made the bar seats very sought after to sit down and eat at, as opposed to the tables. Now, we still get people who want to sit in the back, but the bar has really become the attraction to sit down and eat at. It's a little more spacious. You see what's going on. We have the raw bar in the front. And the other thing, I have a full liquor license, but I do not do a full bar. So what we did was just make specialty cocktails, as opposed to coming in and saying, I don't even have tonic water. So if you want the gin and tonic, you can't have it. We have gin. You want gin on the rocks, I can do it for you. But so we just made specialty cocktails.
Now, why would you do that?
The only reason, in fact, it'd be the opposite direction of what you want to do. Generally, you think liquor, more profitability.
Yeah.
But because the space was so limited, because the demand for the dining area was so high, we felt it more important to be able to get the people in to sit down and eat as opposed to just having people sitting there drinking. Mm-hmm. We wanted to turn the seats over. We wanted it to be about fresh seafood. And in order to have fresh seafood, you got to sell seafood. And in order to sell seafood, you have to have people eating it.
That's right.
So
and you have to have a place for them to eat.
Exactly.
What keeps you up at night?
Oh, what keeps me up at night? What doesn't keep me up at night? The building falling down.
Well, your baby?
The baby definitely keeps me up at night as well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, little things that keep me up at night. Is the delivery coming in on time? What's the price of the lobster? Am I missing anything? Is somebody not going to show up to work? I mean, it's a combination of so many things that when your head goes down and when it wakes up 4 or 5 hours later, that's what I'm thinking about. Everybody come to work today still. I still place all my own fish orders at night. Every single night, all year, I get the list of stuff that's left, and I still place every fish order every night the restaurant's open.
You know, you can tell. The thing, I'll say it again, the thing I love about your restaurant is really your restaurant. You feel there's a person there. There's a personality there. You're not going into, you know, so, because I think, you know, I'm not criticizing any other chef, but many chefs, you know, after they've done it and they're successful and they're there 4 years, 5 years, they want to do the next restaurant. They want to be somewhere else. They grow. They're off doing TV or whatever. I mean, we all have to promote, you know, the restaurants, but it's, and I think many, many people that dream of going into the business dream of having your restaurant. So it's, I'm going to tell people it's on Lafayette Street,
yes.
Right? It's not far. It's in Soho, you know, Ed's Lobster Bar. You've got to go there. You've got to try the lobster roll. I never plug restaurants. I talk to the chef. I just want to have people go there. And especially if you're thinking of ever owning your own restaurant, this to me is one of the most perfect run examples of that.
You know, one of the things that, and I think it's everybody's view of success is a little different, that I just want to add to what you said. And for me, people say, oh my God, you're open 2 years, you're open 3 years, you're open 7 years. You're so successful. And since day one, I've told people, you're not successful until you're open 10 years. And that's basically what my vision has been. It's 10 years. And I'm still there in 10 years and plugging away. I've had a successful restaurant. That's what stood the test of time. Because I think that you know, plenty of people, like you said, 5 years and they start going off and doing all sorts of other things and they really lose track of everything. I think that if you're open for 10 years in New York City, you've done something pretty impressive.
You know what they said, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Ed, to do that for 10 years, you're amazing. That's what I love about you. And can you believe we've run out of time? So, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
And it's really been enjoyable. And I'll be in soon for my lobster.
Excellent. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Thanks. And I want to shout out to Robin Cohen, my producer. And I want to thank people at Heritage Radio Network. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.